Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, January 14th, 2006, the day before Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Here's what we have coming up for you. After the news, we'll hear excerpts from Martin Luther King Jr.'s Riverside speech in honor of his birthday tomorrow. We will then hear numerous commentaries on current issues of war, peace, and politics. We'll also bring you lots of music today, anticipating some exciting upcoming concerts of people's music. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. First, for news, read by Steve Diamond.
And now for some news. From the Los Angeles Times on January 12, 2006. U.S. lifts longtime drilling ban on Alaskan wildlife habitat. The Department of Interior on Wednesday approved oil and gas drilling on Alaskan land considered such sensitive wildlife habitat that it was first protected by former Interior Secretary James G. Watt under President Reagan. The decision, decried by Native American, hunting, and environmental groups, comes just weeks after the U.S. Senate rejected drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, about 200 miles to the east. Bureau of Land Management staff said the decision was made after 3 years of study and in response to requests by Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. The plan, signed by Deputy Assistant Interior Secretary Chad Calvert, will open up more than 500,000 acres in and around Teshekpuk Lake on Alaska's oil-rich North Slope. Bureau of Land Management officials estimate the Northeast National Petroleum Reserve, including the lake area, may contain as much as 2 billion barrels of economically recoverable oil. The area is a critical stop for molting geese on the Pacific Flyway, and up to 46,000 caribou use areas near the lake for calving and migration paths. Although many Alaskans welcome drilling as an economic boon, some native leaders in the state blasted the decision. "There are a lot of frustrated people in our community right now," said Dora Nukapiguk, Inupiat Eskimo village of Nuiksut on the eastern edge of the reserve, where many people depend on caribou as a food source. She added, "It's a very sensitive area. It seems like regardless of what we say or do with the Bureau of Land Management, they'll do what they're going to do anyways, and that's drill." And from Knight Ritter, on January 11, 2006, U.S. airstrikes in Iraq could intensify. U.S. warplanes have carried out hundreds of airstrikes in Iraq in the past 2 years, bombing and strafing fighters and targets almost daily. And the air war, which has gone largely unnoticed at home, could intensify once American ground forces start to withdraw. Since Iraq doesn't have a working air force, U.S. jets are expected to provide air cover for at least several more years. Some analysts have raised questions about how effective air power can be. A key fear is that Iraq's mostly Shiite Muslim and Kurdish army will use American and Allied bombing missions for revenge attacks on the Sunni Muslim Arab minority. Larry C. Johnson, a former CIA and State Department official, said, "If we allow that to happen, then in essence we'll be doing the same thing we accused Saddam Hussein of doing. We'll just be substituting one tyranny for another." Air Force officials say that only U.S. military teams embedded with Iraqi forces will be allowed to direct airstrikes. American military officials say they try to minimize civilian casualties as much as possible. Nevertheless, civilians die. On January 2nd, a U.S. plane bombed a house in northern Iraq where resistance fighters were thought to be hiding, killing at least 8 people, including 2 children, according to news reports. Central Command said its air missions are meant to, quote, "support coalition troops, infrastructure protection, reconstruction activities, and operations to deter and disrupt terrorist activities." And from The Guardian on January 12, 2006. Hamas drops call for destruction of Israel from manifesto. Hamas has dropped its call for the destruction of Israel from its manifesto for the Palestinian parliamentary election in a fortnight, a move that brings the group closer to the mainstream Palestinian position of building a state within the boundaries of the occupied territories. The Islamist faction still calls for the maintenance of an armed struggle against occupation, but it steps back from Hamas's 1988 charter demanding Israel's eradication and the establishment of a Palestinian state in its place. The group is expected to emerge as the second largest party after the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah, in the next Palestinian parliament. Opinion polls give it more than a third of the popular vote, built on a campaign against Fatah's endemic corruption and mismanagement and failure to contain growing criminality, and by claiming credit for driving the Israeli army and settlers out of Gaza. Ghazi Hamad, a Hamas candidate in the Gaza Strip, yesterday said the manifesto reflected the group's position of accepting an interim state based on the 1967 borders, but leaving a final decision on whether to recognize Israel to future generations. Mr. Hamad said the armed resistance was no longer Hamas's primary strategy. He said, "The policy is to maintain the armed struggle, but it is not our first priority. We know that first of all, we have to put more effort into resolving the internal problems, dealing with corruption, blackmail, chaos. This is our priority because if we change the situation for the Palestinians, it will make our cause stronger." Hamas is looking to establish a new political strategy in which all Palestinian groups will participate, and not just be dominated by Fatah. And from the Associated Press on January 11th, Pinochet stripped of legal immunity. An appeals court in Santiago, Chile, stripped General Augusto Pinochet of his legal immunity Wednesday, a ruling that paved the way for the former dictator to stand trial on charges of responsibility for killing two bodyguards of President Salvador Allende, whom he toppled in a bloody 1973 coup. The ruling allows the judge handling the case to indict the 90-year-old retired general. Pinochet, who ruled Chile from 1973 to 1990, enjoys immunity from prosecution as a former president, but he faces a host of charges of human rights abuses, tax evasion, and corruption. Wednesday's ruling reopened one of the most notorious human rights cases involving Pinochet's dictatorship, the so-called Caravan of Death, in which 75 jailed dissidents were killed by a military party that toured the country in a helicopter in the weeks immediately after the coup. The Caravan of Death case had been closed and all charges against Pinochet dropped on health grounds, but a prosecution lawyer discovered that two of the victims had not been included in the original process and filed a new complaint. And from the Washington Post on January 13, tough interrogation tactics were opposed. Members of a Defense Department investigative task force were told not to participate in aggressive interrogation techniques approved for use at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in 2002, because officers and lawyers believed the tactics violated policy and would not elicit information, according to documents released by the Pentagon. The aggressive techniques were approved by Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in late 2002, and similar tactics later emerged in Iraq and were highlighted in photographs of abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison. Members of the Pentagon's Criminal Investigation Task Force worked with FBI agents to investigate possible crimes that the detainees may have committed. Declassified email messages and orders show that their commanders were concerned about the tactics almost immediately after they were implemented and joined FBI officials in reporting allegations of abuse. The memos indicate that even military units at Guantanamo Bay pushed back against the department's efforts to use new, aggressive tactics against detainees during the facility's first year. American Civil Liberties Union attorney Amrit Singh, whose organization obtained the documents in a lawsuit, said, "It just confirms that the policies that were adopted at Guantanamo were adopted as a matter of policy and over significant objections, not just within the FBI, but within units of the Army. It calls into question the adequacy of the investigations the military undertook. It underscores that high-ranking officials were responsible for the abusive techniques that were put in place." Major General Jeffrey D. Miller was in charge of the Guantanamo Bay mission, and the interrogations at the time top Pentagon officials approved the tactics. Miller, who later traveled to Iraq to help establish the Abu Ghraib prison, this week invoked his right not to incriminate himself in abuse cases against two low-ranking soldiers. Pentagon officials said Miller's application for retirement has been approved. Rumsfeld told reporters at the Pentagon yesterday that there is no evidence to suggest that high-level policies authorized or condoned the abuse of detainees.
Oh, freedom. And go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Oh, freedom.
Oh, freedom. Over me.
Over me.
And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave, and I go home to my Lord and be free.
Yes, to be free.
No more darkness.
No darkness.
No more darkness.
No darkness.
No more darkness over me.
Over me.
And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave, and I'd go home to my Lord and be free.
Yes, to be free.
There'll be glory.
Glory
there'll be glory.
Glory
there'll be glory over me.
Over me.
And before I'd be a slave,
oh, you know,
I'd be buried in my grave, and I'd go home to my Lord and be free.
And I'll be free.
Freedom,
oh, freedom,
oh, freedom, oh, freedom, over me,
over me.
And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave, and I'd go home to my Lord and be free.
Yes, I'd be free.
Yes, before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave, and go home to my Lord and be free,
and I'll be free.
Yes, before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave, and go home to my Lord.
That was Oh Freedom by Kim and Reggie Harris. Kim and Reggie Harris will be playing on Friday, January 27th at 7 p.m. at the People's Music Network concert, Standing Our Ground. This will happen at Amherst College in Amherst, Mass. For more information, contact Dia Crow, DiaCrowe, at yahoo.com. Delivered at Riverside Church in New York on April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year before his assassination in Memphis at age 39, Dr. King spoke out powerfully against the war in Vietnam. His speech contains much that we can learn from today as we wage yet another war. We will play you excerpts from his speech, and we encourage you to track it down to read or to listen to in its entirety.
I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. I join you in this meeting because I'm in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization which has brought us together, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, In the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. And we must rejoice as well, for surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movements and pray that our own inner being may be sensitive to its guidance. For we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation, my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place and it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. we were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. For those who ask the question, aren't you a civil rights leader? And thereby mean to exclude me from the movement for peace, I have this further answer. In 1957, when a group of us formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. We were convinced that we could not limit our vision to certain rights for black people, but instead affirmed the conviction that America would never be free or saved from itself until the descendants of its slaves were loosed completely from the shackles they still wear. In a way, we were agreeing with Langston Hughes, that black Bart of Harlem, who had written earlier, "Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." Now, it should be incandescently clear that no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of men the world over. So it is that those of us who are yet determined that America will be are led down the path of protest and dissent, working for the health of our land. As if the weight of such a commitment to the life and health of America were not enough, another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1954, and I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was also a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances. But even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and for white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them, what then can I say to the Viet Cong, or to Castro, or to Mao as a faithful minister of this one? Can I threaten them with death, or must I not share with them my life? And finally, as I try to explain for you and for myself the road that leads from Montgomery to this place, I would have offered all that was most valid if I simply said that I must be true to my conviction that I share with all men the calling to be a son of the living God. Beyond the calling of race, a nation, a creed, is this vocation of sonship and brotherhood. Because I believe that the Father is deeply concerned, especially for his suffering and helpless and outcast children, I come tonight to speak for them. This I believe to be the privilege and the burden of all of us who deem ourselves bound by allegiances and loyalties, which are broader and deeper than nationalism, and which go beyond our nation's self-defined goals and positions. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. Is our nation planning to build on political myth again, and then show it up upon the power of new violence? Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence, when it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. We have seen emerge a pattern of suppression which has now justified the presence of U.S. military advisors in Venezuela. This need to maintain social stability for our investments accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, and why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. It is with such activity in mind that the words of the late John F. Kennedy come back to haunt us. 5 years ago, he said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed, so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values. That is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war. There's nothing to keep us from molding a recalcitrant status quo with bruised hands until we have fashioned it into a brotherhood. These are days which demand wise restraint and calm reasonableness. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. If we will but make the right choice, we will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Shalom.
That was Emma's Revolution with Peace, Salam, Shalom. Emma's Revolution will also be playing at the People's Music Network concert in Amherst, Mass. On Friday, January 27th. We go back to Steve Diamond now to hear more about domestic spying authorized by Bush.
Bush authorized domestic spying before 9/11 by Jason Leopold from Truth Out on January 13th. The National Security Agency advised President Bush in early 2001 that it had been eavesdropping on Americans during the course of its work monitoring suspected terrorists and foreigners believed to have ties to terrorist groups, according to a declassified document. The NSA's vast data mining activities began shortly after Bush was sworn in as president, and the document contradicts his assertion that the 9/11 attacks prompted him to take the unprecedented step of signing a secret executive order authorizing the NSA to monitor a select number of American citizens thought to have ties to terrorist groups. In its Transition 2001 report, the NSA said that the ever-changing world of global communication means that, quote, American communication and targeted adversary communication will coexist. Make no mistake, NSA can and will perform its missions consistent with the Fourth Amendment and all applicable laws, the document says. However, it also adds that, quote, senior leadership must understand that the NSA's mission will demand a powerful, permanent presence on global communications networks that host both protected communications of Americans and communications of adversaries the agency wants to target. What had long been understood to be protocol in the event the NSA spied on average Americans was that the agency would black out the identities of those individuals or immediately destroy the information. But according to people who worked at the NSA as encryption specialists during this time, that's not what happened. On orders from Defense Department officials and President Bush, the agency kept a running list of the names of Americans in its system and made it readily available to a number of senior officials in the Bush administration, these sources said, which in essence meant the NSA was conducting a covert domestic surveillance operation in violation of the law. James Risen, author of the book State of War, and credited with first breaking the story about the NSA's domestic surveillance operations, said President Bush personally authorized a change in the agency's long-standing policies shortly after he was sworn in 2001. The president personally and directly authorized new operations, like the NSA's domestic surveillance program, that almost certainly would never have been approved under normal circumstances and that raised serious legal or political questions, Risen wrote in the book. Because of the fevered climate created throughout the government by the president and his senior advisors, Bush sent signals of what he wanted done, without explicit presidential orders, and the most ambitious got the message. The NSA's domestic surveillance activities that began in early 2001 reached a boiling point shortly after 9/11, when senior administration officials and top intelligence officials asked the NSA to share that data with other intelligence officials who worked for the FBI and the CIA to hunt down terrorists that might be in the United States. However, the NSA, on advice from its lawyers, destroyed the records, fearing the agency could be subjected to lawsuits by American citizens identified in the agency's raw intelligence reports. The declassified report says that the director of the National Security Agency is obligated by law to keep Congress fully and currently informed of intelligence activities. But that didn't happen. When news of the NSA's clandestine domestic spying operation, which President Bush said he had authorized in 2002, was uncovered last month by the New York Times, Democratic and Republican members of Congress appeared outraged, claiming that they were never informed of the covert surveillance operation. It's unclear whether the executive order signed by Bush removes the NSA director from his duty to brief members of Congress about the agency's intelligence gathering programs. Eavesdropping on Americans requires intelligence officials to obtain a surveillance warrant from a special court and show probable cause that the person they want to monitor was communicating with suspected terrorists overseas. But Bush said the process for obtaining such warrants under the 1979 Federal Intelligence Surveillance Act was, at times, quote, cumbersome. In a December 22nd letter to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Assistant Attorney General William E. Muscella wrote, "The President determined what was necessary following September 11th to create an early warning detection system. FISA could not have provided the speed and agility required for the early warning detection system." However, what remains murky about that line of reasoning is that after 9/11, former Attorney General John Ashcroft undertook a full-fledged lobbying campaign to loosen the rules and the laws governing FISA to make it easier for the intelligence community to obtain warrants for wiretaps to spy on Americans who might have ties to terrorists. Since the legislative change, more than 4,000 surveillance warrants have been approved by the FISA court, leading many to wonder why Bush selectively chooses to bypass the court for what he says were select numbers of individuals. More than a dozen legal scholars dispute Mostello's legal analysis, saying in a letter just sent to Congress that the White House failed to identify, quote, any plausible legal authority for such surveillance. The program appears on its face to violate existing law, wrote scholars of constitutional law, some of whom worked in various senior capacities in Republican and Democratic administrations, in an extraordinary letter to Congress that laid out, point by point, why the president is unauthorized to permit the NSA to spy on Americans and how he broke the law by approving it. Even conceding that the president, in his role as commander-in-chief, may generally collect signals intelligence on the enemy abroad, Congress indisputably has authority to regulate electronic surveillance within the United States, as it has done in FISA. The letter states, where Congress has so regulated, the President can act in contravention of statute only if his authority is exclusive, that is, not subject to the check of statutory regulation. The Department of Justice letter pointedly does not make that extraordinary claim. The Supreme Court has never upheld warrantless wiretapping within the United States. It adds, if the administration felt that FISA was insufficient, the proper course was to seek legislative amendment, as it did with other aspects of FISA in the Patriot Act, and as Congress expressly contemplated when it enacted the wartime wiretap provision in FISA. The letter continues, one of the crucial features of a constitutional democracy is that it is always open to the President, or anyone else, to seek to change the law, but is also beyond dispute that, in such a democracy, the President cannot simply violate criminal laws behind closed doors because he deems them obsolete or impracticable. Jeffrey Smith, the former general counsel for the CIA under the Clinton administration, also weighed in on the controversy Wednesday. Smith said he wants to testify at hearings that Bush overstepped his authority and broke the law. His own legal opinion on the spy program was included in a 14-page letter to the House Select Committee on Intelligence that said that President Bush does not have the legal authority to order the NSA to spy on American citizens. It is not credible that the 2001 authorization to use force provides authority for the President to ignore the requirements of FISA, Smith wrote, adding that if President Bush's executive order authorizing a covert domestic surveillance operation is upheld as legal, quote, it would be a dramatic expansion of presidential authority affecting the rights of our fellow citizens that undermines the checks and balances of our system, which lie at the very heart of the Constitution. Still, one thing that appears to be indisputable is that the NSA surveillance began well before 9/11, and months before President Bush claims Congress gave him the power to use military force against terrorist threats, which Bush says is why he believed he had the legal right to bypass the judicial process. According to the online magazine Slate, an unnamed official in the telecom industry said NSA's efforts to obtain call details go back to early 2001, predating the 9/11 attacks and the president's now-celebrated secret executive order. The source reports that the NSA approached U.S. carriers and asked for their cooperation in a data mining operation, which might eventually cull millions of individual calls and emails. Once again, that article was by Jason Leopold. He spent 2 years covering California's electricity crisis as Los Angeles Bureau Chief of Dow Jones Newswires.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for reading that analysis about domestic spying. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. Now for some commentary from Jav Parrish at Pacifica Network.
It's the constitutional crises of 2006. This is Jav Parrish. In 2005's waning days, Beltway developments pointed to 2006 as a pivotal year in the future of American democracy. The most far-reaching of these developments was George Bush's aggressive advocacy of his program of secret domestic NSA spying. The only way his program can be construed as legal is if the president has the authority to override any law. That is exactly George Bush's claim. Given that Bush and his cabal have predicted that the war on terror may last up to 100 years, the president is actually claiming that the rule of law need not apply for generations to come. Bush is proclaiming the right as a wartime president to do anything he likes. Anything. Why not disband Congress? Why not suspend the 2008 elections? Anything. This is deeply alarming. Surveillance of the National Security Agency, or NSA, operates by creating search terms and using computers to monitor not just suspected Al-Qaeda operatives, but all Americans' international calls, emails, and faxes. This would certainly explain why Bush didn't use FISA courts to obtain warrants no court would allow surveillance upon countless millions of Americans. Done in secret, with accountability only to a highly politicized White House, there is absolutely nothing to prevent Bush and his cronies from using the NSA to illegally spy upon anyone they want. The 2006 constitutional crisis is not simply confined to the executive branch either. Lobbyist Jack Abramoff pled guilty Tuesday to wire fraud and forgery charges in exchange for his cooperation in the corruption investigation of members of Congress and their aide. More than four dozen congresspersons accepted large donations, gifts, or travel from Abramoff at the same time that they took legislative action favorable to him or his clients. That's only one lobbyist out of tens of thousands within the Beltway. The Abramoff scandals threaten to unveil the ugly way in which bipartisan Capitol Hill bribery works. It's democracy for the highest bidder. A profound crisis for democracy, and it comes at exactly the same time that a Republican-dominated Congress and a Republican-stacked Supreme Court are the only political institutions that can rein in the lawless excesses of the Bush administration. The only real solution to all this is a clean sweep. Congress must reject Alito and rein in the Patriot Act. And if Congress is, as Bush once said of the UN, to remain relevant, it must impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. Widespread citizen outrage will be needed to force a corrupt and reluctant Congress to act. And in November of 2006, regardless of party, we must replace corrupted lawmakers with candidates who are truly responsive and accountable to the ordinary people who elect them. It's either that, or by the year 2007, we'll be living in a de facto dictatorship. It's our choice. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Job Parrish.
A craft from another galaxy has landed on our world. So listen to the story that's about to be unfurled. It landed in the backyard behind the garden shed. I knew I wasn't dreaming and I hadn't hit my head. I thought that it was a hologram or some elaborate hoax. I know my friends are clever and they like these kinds of jokes. I had to find the answer to alleviate my fear. So I put my hands around it, but it didn't disappear. That wasn't what I expected, so I had to form a plan. I very well could be their first example of a man. They opened up their door and several aliens oozed out. I cleared my throat and asked them what their trip was all about. The aliens from another world began to tell their tale. We've come to capture criminals who busted out of jail. These criminals are masterminds, they're evil to the core. We've come to save the planet Earth from what they have in store. Then after a while they turned and asked me if I'd help their cause. They wanted me to tell them all about this planet's laws. I sat there by the garden shed, I told them all I knew. I talked about the government and what the people do. They fed that to their computer as they waited by the shed. Then take us to your leader was the only thing they said. I told them that the president was quite a busy Joe, but maybe he would help them if they told him what they know. You probably did not understand the meaning of our plea. We do not want his help, the alien creature said to me. Your president and cabinet are the gangsters we must find. Are you gonna help us now or have you changed your mind? Well, they wanted to find our president and zap him back to space. They claimed it was a monster who'd betrayed the human race. They wanted me to sneak them into Washington, D.C., where they would take our government into their custody. I knew the administration had a heavy rap to face, but were they illegal aliens who came from outer space? Could they be extradited? Would they ever serve their time? Locked up in some galactic jail to pay for all their crimes. So I wondered about our government and all that they had done. Their policies are inhumane, that's plain to everyone. So finally I stood up and I said with all my might, I think if they were human, they'd believe in human rights. And I know that I want to help you, but I'm sure that's not the way. I know that we would never make it past the CIA, and they'd laugh us off the planet if we ever got that far. For there's no way to expose them for the aliens that they are. But now that we know our government has come from outer space, to vote them out of office, that's the challenge that we face. Let's educate and organize our neighbors and our friends. A truly human government is just around the bend.
That was Jay Mankita with Illegal Aliens from Outer Space. Now, more from Jav Parrish at Pacifica.
Close isn't good enough. This is Jav Parrish. During the reign of George Bush Sr., Democrats mounted a ferocious campaign to thwart the Supreme Court nomination of Clarence Thomas. Much of the opposition focused on Thomas's record as an employer and his alleged sexism, not on his radically conservative judicial views. Thomas was narrowly approved, and in the 17 years since, all that opposition during his confirmation hearings has mattered not at all. From the first, Thomas has gleefully run roughshod over the Constitution at every opportunity, and with no public accountability for Supreme Court justices, that is exactly what Thomas will likely continue to do for the rest of his life. Enter Samuel Alito. All this week, senators have had their only opportunity to question Alito on his controversial record as a judge and as an executive branch attorney. There's no question of Alito's experience and competence as a judge, nor are there any major Thomas-like blemishes on Alito's personal character. Now, most of the concern about Alito is ideological, and historically, very few nominees for the Supreme Court are rejected on ideological grounds. Moreover, Alito's ideology is one shared by many Republicans, and Republicans have a solid 55-44 majority in the Senate. Even if every Democrat agrees that Alito is bad news, and when was the last time Democrats agreed on anything, it will take 7 more Republicans to join with them to stop Alito's nomination. Showing their usual lack of backbone, Democrats are said to be reluctant to engage in a filibuster. But even if they do, Alito's nomination is something conservative Republicans will fight for. Bill Frist and his colleagues wouldn't hesitate to invoke the nuclear option, in the process not only guaranteeing Alito's ascension, but forever destroying the right of a Senate minority to filibuster. And Alito is as bad as it gets. Most Democrats on the Judiciary Committee have hammered away this week on Alito's extreme views of executive branch power. Some have inquired as to whether Alito still feels Roe v. Wade should be abolished. On any number of critical issues like this, Alito will be that essential fifth swing vote, meaning that his confirmation would in all likelihood usher in a new, reactionary Supreme Court era that could last a generation. The problems with Samuel Alito go far beyond abortion and the power of the executive branch. Alito has never met an expanded government power that he didn't approve of, and the same is true of his view of corporate power. Conversely, Alito has sought to limit the rights of ordinary people. And there's more, Alito's long membership in a Princeton alumni group that opposed the admission of women and minorities. And there's Alito's refusal as a federal judge to recuse himself from cases involving a company in which he'd invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, even though he promised to do so during his confirmation hearings. If he blew off his promise of recusal in a previous nomination hearing, why should anyone believe anything he's saying this week? The chances, at this point, that Alito can be stopped are slim, but an effort must be made. As with Clarence Thomas, getting close won't mean anything. Every Senate Democrat should be the target of emails, faxes, phone calls, letters, and office visits. The same goes for moderate Republicans, Lincoln Chafee, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, Chuck Hagel, George Voinovich, James Jeffords, and Arlen Specter are 7 of the likeliest to vote no. The stakes in this vote are enormous. We've got to stop this guy. Do something. Samuel Alito's ascension would all but lock in decades of Supreme Court domination by the executive branch, corporations, and social conservatives. The Supreme Court is the highest level of the only branch of government not already wholly controlled by conservative Republicans. Don't let it go without a fight. From KBCS, for Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.